I recently co-edited a book for Camarion Press called Cinderella or Cyberella. And, you know, it's a bit hokey, the title. But hopefully it conveys something of what I'm trying to say. And just to do some definitions, the subtitle of it was Empowering Women in the Knowledge Society. All of these terms, empowering and knowledge society, are up to a great deal of variation in definition. So I wanted to tell you how myself and Sophia, the co-editor, saw these terms. Mark Malok Brown, who some of you know, who was the administrator of UNDP and now is the Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, he talked about the tremendous importance of the new technology for Africa. And I would like to apply what he sees as the empowerment aspect of it to women worldwide. He says that the new technology, with that, people will invent new uses and expand their lives, in the process becoming agents of change rather than passive recipients of aid. So looking at empowerment that way, to become the agent of change. And the Knowledge Society, so often the Knowledge Society is focusing very much on tertiary level education, on science and technology education, and on a very elite segment of education. But I see the Knowledge Society as the use of ICTs for development grounded in empowering the poor and increasing scientific and technological capacity of the whole society in a way that is consistent with development, with equitable development, and that supports democratic decision-making, it supports more effective governance, and lifelong learning. So we were looking at empowering women in the information society that way. But why we took this little Cinderella versus Cyberella analogy, we see that Cinderella, in terms of informatization, works in the basement of the knowledge society, if she works in it at all, with little opportunity to reap its benefits, and waits for her prince to decide the benefits that she will receive. And what we are looking for is for women to be able to benefit equally from the possibilities of the Knowledge Society, from positions of empowerment, which means independence, choice, capabilities, and action. And I apologize for this terrible picture of a Cyberella. It's not exactly cross-cultural, and it's a little heavy on the misanthropy, but doesn't exactly represent poor women in developing countries, but they didn't seem to have the right one there in Google Images. But what is Cyberella? How do we see what we would aim for is women globally who are fluent in the uses of technology, comfortable using and designing computer technology, equipment, software, working in virtual spaces, devising innovative uses for technologies across problems and subjects, finding information and knowledge in order to improve their lives and expand the choices, becoming active knowledge creators and disseminators, and more than users, designing information and knowledge systems to improve all aspects of their lives. Sue Rosser, who is dean of the Ivan Allen College at Georgia Tech, she's got an analysis which is quite similar to this of the phases of gender and ICT inclusion, the stages of women's relationship globally to gender and information technology. And she defines the first stage as the absence of women's concerns, and that their presence, that their absence from the information technology sector is not noted. And the second stage she defines as women's issues and concerns coming as add-ons to existing structures and designs, but not seen as problems. But rather seen as problems, anomalies, and deviance from the norms of information technology. In the third stage, it's when women are seen as legitimate workers, users, and designers of ICTs. And the final stage is the full inclusion of women in all of these aspects. But I think if we took a global view of the situation, we'd have to say that women, for the most part, are still in stage one. And this is particularly reflected by the statistics and the indicators that we have about their situation. There are very few countries that collect sex-disaggregated statistics or indicators with regard to information technology. According to Orbicom's project Measuring the Information Society, which is led by George Siadis, the comprehensive ICT data with a gender dimension across a large number of countries do not currently exist. That's the general picture. And the general conclusion from that picture is that without data, there is no visibility. Without visibility, there is no priority. So the move to have more statistics and indicators that reflect differences between men and women in terms of access to and use of information technologies is very, very important. The major disseminator, publisher disseminator of global statistics on information and communication technologies is the ITU, the International Telecommunication Union. And up until 2003, they did not publish any statistics on ICTs globally that were disaggregated by sex, where they had figures for men and women, except for the only statistic that they had was on men and women in telecoms administrations countries, meaning you could know how many women telephone operators there were in Dubai. but that's essentially what it represented. When you saw a figure of more than 50% of women in telecoms administrations, it largely meant as manual telephone operators. But in 2003, they published for the first time female internet users as a percentage of total internet users based on 2002 statistics. Now, problems with this data, which is regrettably the only international data which is systematically collected and disseminated. First of all, they haven't updated it since 2002. That is the only data set that ever got published. Secondly, it's only 39 countries of the world, and the countries that they are showing are not very representative. For Africa, there's only one country, South Africa. For the Middle East, they've only got one country, Israel. For Latin America, it's the five richest countries. They've got Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Mexico, and Venezuela. And they do have a lot of Asian countries, but some of the most significant are not represented. There is no India, for instance. So the available data that we have, which is disaggregated by sex, is data which reflects the global digital divide in the sense of it shows the more highly connected countries. And then there's also the question of the significance of that little data that we have. What is the importance of knowing the percentage of female internet users if what we know is among the percentage of female users among internet users, if what we know is that the percentage of women users of the internet in many developing countries is less than 1% of the overall population. It's an elite within an elite. Um, More recently, this is more show and tell. More recently, there's been some work that I was also involved in with Orbicom. Orbicom is the network of UNESCO chairs of communication, and it's based at University of Montreal, University of Quebec at Montreal. And it's a project called Measuring the Information Society that I mentioned before under the leadership of George Siadis. And what was unique about this project is that in its 2005 iteration, for the first time, it did a major module on trying to look at statistics and indicators on women in the information society. And there are six copies here. It was about all I could carry, but they're available to whoever wants them and at no charge on the way out. So this project module on women in the Information Society was the first attempt at systematic data collection, both quantitative and qualitative, of women in the Information Society globally. And what the project did was scan absolutely every existing source and put them together in a database with due attempt to deal with all the problems of different standards and different methods of collection, etc., and to come out with some at least initial results that are now going to be continued and updated and refined. But this was quite significant, the major finding that came out here, which was the relationship between internet penetration and the proportion of female internet users. What it shows, the green lines are for countries, and the country names have been stripped off, but you can, in the publication, you can restore those. But basically what it was trying to show was variation from countries with a high level of participation. So that this is probably at the left end, this is probably Korea, U.S., Canada in terms of highest level of participation and with some of the least participation, and how that goes with the percentage of female users. And what you can see from the magenta line is it doesn't match at all. And this is just extremely significant because this gives the lie to all of the standard approaches that technology is gender neutral. DFID just recently came out with a study that said all you have to do is get it out there and then it will trickle down evenly to everyone, men and women, rich and poor. It isn't happening that way. There's all sorts of anomalies. First of all, what we can see is that there's a gender divide even in countries with high what the Measuring the Information Society calls info states, which is a kind of a measure of a country's capital, resources, labor, level of technology. And that there are countries that have a high info state, meaning high overall penetration of information technology, but that have large gender gaps. This is not the case, by the way, in terms of at least the findings with regard to U.S. and Canada. U.S. and Canada are countries which have a high level of internet penetration, but at least on usage and access, relative gender parity. But other countries that are at very similar levels of internet penetration have pretty large gender gaps. And among them are France, Germany, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Norway, and the UK. And this set of countries, which do have a high level of internet penetration, have rates of women internet users that are similar to countries which with a fairly low rate of what Orbicom calls info states. And so they match Brazil, Mexico, Zimbabwe, and Tunisia, which are much further down on the internet penetration. Italy, which is high on the penetration, has the same rate of percentage of female users of the internet as Kyrgyzstan, which is not noted for its internet penetration. And Greece and Portugal are close to the bottom of countries on female internet users, even though these are well-developed in terms of internet technology. And countries which are close to the top in terms of female percentage of internet users are Mongolia and the Philippines. So what's striking is that it's all over the place. And meaning that if you, meaning several things, but among them are, it means that it takes care of the argument that you don't have to take care of gender, it'll take care of itself. You do. You have to make specific efforts to ensure that both men and women enjoy the benefits of information technology. And it also shows that the gender divide and the overall digital divide do not move in tandem. So, what's going on out there with regard to women and the knowledge society? Where is most of the attention going? This is just a kind of a really rough survey of the literature in terms of where is the major attention to this topic globally. The huge proportion, particularly in the Western, but also in the non-Western world as well, it looks at women in the ICT industry, the information technology industry, and in ICT-enabled businesses. And by this, I would include the whole category of outsourcing, remote processing, and the intersections with globalization. And, you know, for ICT-enabled remote service jobs, there's all kinds of names that are used for it. If you are a Lou Dobbs watcher, then it's outsourcing. It's also called CBSS. Cross-border servicing and services, sourcing and services. The name which is used in India most frequently is BPO, business process outsourcing. And ITES, you also get that, information technology-enabled services. But the big issue here is the issues of women in call center employment. I'm not going to go into the details of that because it's already several PhD dissertations worth. And issues about the global spread of remote service jobs. But other areas in which there's a large amount of literature are with regard to women in science and technology, women in science and technology education, the category that I would call Why Aren't More Girls Geeks? And here you find literature about differences between countries in terms of levels of girls' interest, the reasons that girls are less interested than boys in computer science, differentiation in sex patterns on enrollments in information technology. You also get a great deal of studies with regard to the comparative access of men and women to the internet. And on the side of the historical patterns about women using ICTs for advocacy and political empowerment, because it's quite striking that particularly in developing countries, the major first uses of the internet in many places were by women. And with regard to organizing for international conferences like the Earth Summit, like the World Conferences on the United Nations World Conferences on Women in 1995 and 2000. Those are the major areas of focus. What I'd like to look at a little is what do I see as the major challenges with regard to women and the information society and our knowledge society. And I would certainly say that they lie within the women and information technology for development area. And with regard to that, I think that the big challenges are trying to find ways in which information technology can contribute to poverty reduction for poor women in the informal sector, those not informal sector jobs in developing countries, and that can be used for women's improved health, well-being, and income. And I think the particular challenge, which is most interesting, is within the informal sector, looking at ICTs applied to existing businesses and enterprises. And this is where there has not been a great deal of activity as yet. There has been much more activity at looking at the situation of women in ICT-enabled businesses. And as an example of what I mean here, this would be, for instance, Muhammad Yunus's village phone in Bangladesh. That is where the technology is the source of the enterprise. And it's quite, obviously, it's a quite interesting and exemplary one because it's using the technology, it's poor rural women using the technology and gaining empowerment as small-scale entrepreneurs. But what I'd like to see more of is things like Anastasia in Nakaseke in Uganda. Anastasia is now a 78-year-old chicken farmer who was illiterate at the time that she first came in contact with a project called, sponsored by IDRC, called Rural Women Earning Money. That's pretty basic. And it was about, and it was done in Luganda, one of the major languages of Uganda, and it turns out to be the one that Anastasia speaks. And it was done with sound and graphic interfaces so that it could be used by illiterate women. And it showed them many techniques, many skills, gave them many tips for improving the efficiency, productivity, and income of their enterprises. And Anastasia used it to increase the profits from her chicken farming businesses. But in the course of that, she became absolutely taken by the technology, and she has become a kind of a rural circuit rider of the technology in Uganda. She made a visit to the U.S. once, and she implored the sponsors of her trip to get her a solar-powered laptop, which she did. So she goes around the district with her solar-powered laptop. She travels by bus, and her mouse, which she loves, and shows the CD-ROM, which this is done on, because in most cases in rural Uganda, you don't get connectivity, to various women's groups in the district. And so this is an example of using the information technology to apply to the non-formal sector existing enterprises of women in developing countries. And I think this is where the big challenge is. And I also think it's clearly one of the more difficult, but it also could affect a great deal of a large number of persons. So why single out women? One is to point out the myth of the gender-neutral technology, that if you do not look specifically at the different situations of men and women, you do not see the unique constraints that women face, and that the project or the initiative or the program may not be reaching women equally. the general belief is that gender blind, meaning paying no attention to gender, will be gender neutral. And in all the evidence that I've looked at, this is not the case. There is clearly growing attention to gender and women in international development in projects. But gender in international projects with regard to information and communication technology is in many cases the last frontier. I did a study of some 400 World Bank projects with regard to information and communications technologies. And in the overall project, a good 35% of them did incorporate gender issues and gender concerns. But when you looked at the information and communication technology part of the project, the figure was generously 9%. So it becomes a kind of a last frontier. What are some of these constraints? These are quite well known, but for those to whom they are not well known, it's that the form of access in most developing countries is public access, not at-home access. Even when it is at-home access, there are gender differences in terms of who gets access to the computer. It's very high cost at-home access in developing countries. In public access, there's all kinds of gender difficulties to it. There's just, if you look on YouTube, and try gender information technology developing countries, there's a new little film by IDRC which shows the problems of women accessing information technology in public access in Uganda, and it does it very well. And the basic situation is it costs money. The young girls, as opposed to young men, are less likely to have the disposable income. The setting of the public access in developing countries is frequently cyber cafes, which frequently resemble pornography booths. Parents of young girls are not enthusiastic about them going there. Often when it's not a cyber cafe, but a public access internet center, they are set up without regard to whether women would be comfortable in going to that space. Sometimes I've seen them in barber shops or gas stations. Whether the hours are such that it goes with their schedule, whether they have the disposable time. But the other larger factors are that the languages of the internet, that it's still in the major languages of the world, and that women globally are less likely to have knowledge of these. They are more likely to be among the illiterate population of the world. Two-thirds of the world's illiterates are women. The geographical location within a country also makes a difference. Women in developing countries tend to live more in rural areas than in urban areas, and infrastructure tends to be more highly centered in urban rather than rural areas. They are less likely to have the disposable time. Limited mobility. No question that the lack of appropriate content. There are many, many projects that are now starting to provide content which is usable to women in developing countries. You take your laptop and you go and meet Anastasia and you say, I want to show you what's out there. And you get eBay. Is that what it is? You know, is Anastasia going to find much information in her own language, which is relevant to her own situation? There's the phenomenon of technophobia, to which women are particularly prone. There's a whole world of gender socialization about technology, which essentially boils down to it's more for you guys than for us guys. And there's a lot of cultural factors that you don't even normally think about. The WorldLink study about computers in schools in Uganda. The computers were in a building separate from the main classroom. When it came to let's go to computer lab time, the boys ran there, and the teacher said, "Girls don't run. Wait. Walk like a lady." Well, there were 15 seats and 30 students, and the boys got them all. And that was the general pattern. And also the extra hours for the use of the computers were in the evenings when the girls were confined to the dormitory, but the boys weren't. So just these small cultural factors. There's also the fact that within information technology policy at the national level, there's very few countries that have any kind of gender references, gender issues in their information technology policy, mostly because this generally held view that information technology is gender neutral. And it comes from two sides. It comes from the fact that the policymakers don't see or are not aware of the gender issues, but it also comes from the fact that the gender advocates, the Ministry of Women and whatever particular variety it's going to take in the country under concern, or the National Women's Union, that they have very little awareness of the technology issues, so that the two groups do not know how to talk to each other. But what can be done with regard to information technology policy is an education of both groups with regard to gender issues in technical information technology policy. In a number of places, I and others have gone through and taken what are regarded as scary technical terms by non-techies and pointed out what are the gender issues in all of these. And essentially, they boil down to, are the technology choices that are being made such that they are available, equally accessible to both men and women in terms of the actual technology, the software, the language, the cost, etc. All of these aspects, therefore, have their gender aspects. So, overall, is information technology a silver bullet, or is it the latest problem for women? On the side of the latest problem, there's no question that along with the internet, we see an enormous increase in the accessibility and the quantity of pornography, that it's become a tool to facilitate trafficking. Quite recently, we've seen studies that show that it's associated with increased domestic violence and assertions of patriarchy. The examples that I'm thinking of come from studies in Zambia and come from studies in Francophone West Africa, where men get extremely upset when their women visit cyber cafes or want to get cell phones, because they see that activity only as an act of trying to break out. Why are you doing it except to be in contact with other men? And that there have been situations where women picked up the cell phone of their partner and listened to the messages and, you know, got an earful. And then, you know, domestic violence resulted. And in these other situations that I was describing as well. But that's the downside. And to so many phenomenons, there are obviously upsides and downsides. But on the overall, I think that information technologies can contribute a lot to the process of realizing human capabilities, potential, and freedom. Very much the Amartya Sen definition of development. And he is quite aware of the importance of equitable access of women as well as men to information technology. So, thank you.
So many questions leap to mind, but given the lack of statistics even on gender breakdowns and internet usage, are there any useful statistics in any country of breaking down at all in terms of passive use versus creation online or participation in programming activities or, you know, that kind of thing, or the way in which gender differences in internet use break down?
The latter topic, there's a lot. There's a lot, and there's coming to be more and more. First of all, there's a lot in developed countries, but now you find it in developing countries as well.
Because Pew has done some stuff in the States, I know, looking at how men and women use technology.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there's comparative data across the country.
What you would call qualitative data, basically individual projects and studies. One of the best is this one by World Links about education in four African countries. The reference would be in here, but I can get you the reference. The author is Kumba Mar, C-O-U-M-B-A. I'm sorry, Mar Kumba, M-A-R, and then new word, C-O-U-M-B-A. But there, if you dig around on each of the topics that you mentioned, scattered. Yeah. But in terms of put together, not yet. And actually, that's one of the things that I'm working on this year, trying to look for those things and put them together.
Do you know of major grassroots level projects of women actually designing the technologies and the programs for themselves to address some of the issues you've raised?
In terms of the designing, I think that's still the new frontier. Can you think of anything, Ethan? I can think of projects which are designed for women, but where women are really the designers.
Not a ton. I mean, I can come up with examples of sort of individual women doing small projects, but as far as sort of a female-led sort of comprehensive effort, I don't have good examples off the top of my head.
There's no question that with a lot of the projects which are, you know, involving local women, local languages, local knowledge, they are coming up with interesting, innovative uses and adapting the project. The village knowledge centers of the Swaminathan Foundation in southern India, I think that's a good example.
I know at the Media Lab at MIT, there's the Fab Lab project and also the Grassroots Invention Laboratory, but I don't know if there have been specific projects that were focused on women being involved in those things.
Where the women are the designers is the challenge. It also makes a point about Thomas Friedman's book, Because the Earth is Flat, and he talks about innovation can come from anywhere. But if you go through the book, there's not a single reference to gender in there, so he's not looking at that at all. And that's I kind of wanted to write a sequel called The World Isn't Flat Enough.
The world is spiky.
Now, you showed a really interesting graph at sort of the center of the presentation, which is, you know, essentially penetration in different markets and then the sort of wonderful uncorrelated wavy line. And I found myself wondering if you've tried correlation to some other factors that would seem to me to be pretty likely, one of which would be female literacy versus male literacy. I would have to assume that there's a stronger correlation, at least there, than towards net penetration. And I wonder at what point does this get us into the sort of uncomfortable territory we never like to talk about in development, which is culture. Do we see lower penetration of internet access amongst women in countries where you have fewer women going beyond primary school or fewer women who are functionally literate, and so on and so forth. Do you see correlations to parts of the world where we know there are systemic problems as far as women having access to education? I know we don't have the data from the Middle East, but I have to think that that's probably going to be an extremely unhappy picture in some of these cases.
Those are the extremely important points that come out of that graph.
Yeah.
And what Sophia and I, my partner in this crime, are doing this year is we're trying to get funding to commission country studies, and it looks like we've got it for 10 and maybe 20, and to look at exactly these factors on a country-by-country basis, because obviously the factors are varying when you see
sure.
countries like France and Kyrgyzstan getting thrown in the mix. So to look at country studies and to try and isolate those variables.
Yeah.
So hopefully in a year we'll have some more answers.
Add two things to that. One, my recollection is that there is some data that has been collected over the years and shown to be significant in so far as women's participation in the economy as a strong indicator for uptake of new technologies, for technology adoption. So that's just one particular bit. And I would imagine, I don't know if, Rob, if you're aware of that sort of stuff, or you, the other person you might be interested to talk to is Rob Jensen at the Kennedy School. And then the other one is, I think it would be great if you could talk at some point in the remarks about your attempts to gather the next bits of data. The laments on we don't have data on this and we don't have data on that are, I hear for gender, but we similar don't have the data for education or for anything else related to technology, right? So there's just huge data gaps. And I don't know, and the countries that you mentioned that don't have the data are often case the countries that are poor, right? And they don't have the money. They're worried about how do we do whatever it is we're trying to do, educate the kids or whatever, get them to school. And the last thing that they want to do is have a bunch of data, which inevitably show that they're not doing a very good job. So I think there's a real challenge there of how do you pitch the data gathering as both important and to their advantage. And then the related question I have, which maybe loops those back together, is have you looked at the impact of lack of sort of lack of adoption and use of the internet and related technologies by women? And is there an argument to be made that past the educate your girls, they'll have fewer babies and they'll be, you know, whatever the kind of typical development arguments, to go to policymakers and say, it's important that you know whether you're succeeding or failing because look at, you know, these data show that, in fact, if there is not significant penetration among women, you're never going to become the knowledge society that you want to be because of X, Y, and Z. And I don't know if there's research there.
There's a lot of studies that are coming out lately that are making that argument and making it strongly. That if you're talking about the knowledge society, your knowledge society is going to be tremendously weakened by having it limited to 50% of your population. And so particularly within work that's being done towards the knowledge society, there's a lot of push towards gender equity and the knowledge society. And that you're moving against any kind of sustainable development. You're essentially marginalizing extremely significant portion of the population, the potential workforce, and also showing that some countries which are experiencing shortages in educated workforce, that there's a big potential one there that you could use. With regard to the women's participation in the economy, I think that that's probably the variable which is at work with regard to Philippines. Why Philippines is way up there in terms of female internet use. But that's, again, one to be tested.
I'm really hoping you'll get to do a country study in Philippines because I think what everyone will figure out very quickly is that it's NetVideo. It's because you have such a strong diaspora and population, because there's such a long tradition of remittance and communication.
Yeah.
Philippines was a country that jumped on VoIP very early on.
Yeah.
We know that even in low and middle income households, we have people using, you know, EyeSight cameras to do video conferences with their spouses who are living abroad. So Philippines is going to prove to be a very unique situation, but you're going to see a class of net users who ended up adopting sort of cutting-edge internet technology for very basic communications use, and probably some sort of mentoring and coaching woman-to-woman within that society, which should be really interesting.
I'd love to have around-the-table views on which are the countries that you think are, you know, have significant and interesting variables and situations.
I think the other interesting, like, on the statistic, it would be nice to know, like, what actually the usage percentage are, like, what people are actually using the internet for actual productive development work, as opposed to, like, using IM clients, or, like, as he said, in that conference, because a lot of people I know still are both in Nepal and still, like, friends that I have around the United States use internet basically for IM clients and, you know, a few searches here and there, but not much beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I mean, to actually understand female empowerment, I think, you know, it would be nice to actually know what percentage of female users are actually using the internet or using it for something that would actually empower them.
Mm-hmm.
In the true sense.
Or for men. For that matter,
yeah.
Either. That we don't have that for a lot of places. Korea, in terms of a non-Western country, Korea is a leader in the statistics of internet use and was sex disaggregated. And one of the few countries that I've seen that really break this down is Korea. Korea does number of hours per week, site of usage for what, and it does that on a regular basis, and it does it sex disaggregated.
What did they find for Korea?
With regard to what aspect?
A gender usage.
A high level of usage, but the women were using it more for essentially shopping. That was the dominant usage. But Korea had this program called Train a Million Housewives in computer skills. And why housewives was, at the time it was started, there were few women, the percentage of women in the labor force was low. And they got a million housewives. And of the million housewives, many of them went into productive uses of information technology in various forms of e-commerce, in marketing their products, and setting up small businesses, small enterprises, and even in computer ICT-enabled businesses, you know, doing software sort of work and even hardware assembly in some cases. But now they have a program called Train the Second Million Women. But Korea is very much in the lead.
I would I think that the productive uses versus unproductive uses is a false and misleading dichotomy. And I think that the important thing is that people are using technology and becoming conversant and figuring out how they want to use it. And that in all likelihood, it's like a gateway drug, you know, and that you start on one thing and then you say, oh, I can use this for other things. I mean, most of us probably started with email or word processing or whatever, and then you learn new things along the way. So as long as it's not a pejorative saying that chat is bad, but rather it's interesting to see what people use for if it's more communications oriented or more whatever, commerce oriented.
I agree with you completely, because I think that the dominant way that you could describe the situation of poor women in developing countries is isolation, all forms of isolation. And with the new technology, it offers a way out of isolation. It offers information. It offers choices. It offers options. And all of those, no matter how they come, even in an IM, are a broadening that lead you to a wider world and more choices and ultimately more freedom and more growth. Yeah, I
like some statistics about the women creating content versus the, how many women are using it, and what that's like from country to country, and just from the point of view of a female creating content. Like, I believe that if you had more women creating it, then you'd have more usage, and like to see if, you know, if those numbers actually do.
There aren't any statistics of same, at least to my knowledge.
I haven't seen any in the United States or, you know, any of the major developing countries.
Yeah, it's really difficult. The only way to do it is by kind of searches of qualitative material, because even looking at domains by country, that doesn't tell you, because it's not in, it doesn't necessarily tie to the country of origin. And how do you measure it on a statistical basis? Because obviously the number of sites where women are creating content are minuscule compared to the overall material that's out there. I think you have to look at it qualitatively. And on a qualitative basis, what's happening is it's happening, but it needs to happen in more and more places, and certainly it does lead to greater usage. You can say it anecdotally, but
programs that people are creating, are they just mainly focused on getting people to use it versus having them create their own content that they might be interested in and share in their communities?
There's the first, what you described first is sort of the first stage. And it seems that in many, many places we're beyond the first stage now, and we're into the second stage of, you know, encouraging women locally to create their own content, to share their own content, to realize the value in the content that they have, to realize that their knowledge is what we call content.
I think a very important question to ask is, or to push forward, is the economical gains. Specifically, I'm aware that when it comes to empowerment, there's different, like, countries in Latin America and other places that, although they don't have many resources, they use the internet to create sustainability within their communities. So if I were doing this kind of research on how to empower women, and how they use the internet in such a way that it can be empowered, I would focus on the economical side, and that's beyond the nation. It could be used in the United States, as for example, in the case of a woman creating a website for a business, and that could be used in different countries, and the political side of it. I know that around the world there's many people that use the internet to communicate on political issues, and I think that's very important, in that the internet gives space to communicate issues that sometimes are not seen in the real lives of people. So I strongly believe that two units of analysis that could be used for further research could be the economical side, that means how women use the internet to create an economic within the community, and also the political one, in that how women use the internet as a medium to communicate political issues in their respective countries. And that could be used around the world. Mm.
The second part of it, use of the internet as a political medium by women, this one is well documented. You can find many, many things on that.
I was interested, your final slide got me thinking quite a bit with your list of silver bullet or problem for women, and the way in which sort of various opportunities for internet use are structured in a lot of places. And there have been many Asian countries where, you know, you walk into the cyber cafes, it's all boys surfing porn or playing video games. And absolutely, it's not a girl or woman friendly environment in a lot of places. And I guess a few questions come to mind. One being, are funders, both governmental and non-governmental, thinking of developing guidelines for creating, you know, when they're funding kind of environments and ITC structures, are they thinking about guidelines that would create to ensure that ICT usage environments are friendly to both genders? And I guess the other concern is, I mean, one can definitely see a vicious cycle starting here. Not only just you have situations where girls are not encouraged to go to cyber cafes because their parents think that they're going to get raped, or, you know, this kind of thing, or meet inappropriate men or whatever, or become bad people by associating with this. But you also face the danger of educating a generation of men who don't know how to interact in a healthy manner with women in real life. That then leads to a cycle in the way in which people hire technology jobs, the way in which people educate, kind of repeating patterns that could be self-reinforcing in a rather negative way. So I'm just wondering about your thoughts on that.
Well, no, you raised some extremely provocative and thoughtful issues, and the answer is they need further examination. The only donor that I've seen aware of guidelines for public access is IDRC, which has done this wonderful poster about women-friendly telecenters, and I think it's in here, the picture, but it's from several years back, and it's before the cyber cafe turned into the pornography booth. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't particularly show that, but it shows in terms of that they be a welcoming place for women, particularly women with children and women with chickens and, and things like that.
I mean, a follow-on to that, especially since you mentioned the Grameen project and so on, and your wonderful example of the grandmother who's become an evangelist. I'm just curious, has anybody funded a project anywhere, or is there a project anywhere in any country that would be along the lines of giving seed money essentially to the neighborhood grandmother to run a little cyber cafe in her home, or something like that, that would be create an environment that the neighborhood's mothers would feel comfortable allowing their children to interact with?
Village Phone came to be like that because with the women as phone operators, they were doing it in their homes.
Right.
And women were coming to use it. And when it had been male operators, they weren't coming. And this could be transferred to the model of the cyber kiosk, basically. And in India, in the many of the village kiosks, many of them are women run. And also those tend to be the productive uses, or productive and socially acceptable cultural uses of the technology. You know, they're not all productive. They do a lot of things like taking your wedding picture and, you know, matrimonial bureau and like that. But there are many women who are operators. And an interesting study would be, and I don't think I've seen it, of are the women-run, women-owned village information kiosks more heavily frequented by women? I haven't heard from you yet.
Well.
Okay, you, and then I haven't heard from you, and then we'll go.
I heard you mention Kyrgyzstan, so I was wondering if you were able, because it's a good example of separation. Sorry, of culture and
gender issue where, you know, for 70 years women were required to work outside the house, and so they're a lot more educated. Presumably they have to be pretty much 100% literacy to work outside the home. But the Muslim mentality of different sex is still heavily existent. It would be a good example of separation of those two. Did you see anything in the literature?
No, I haven't been there. This is just from the statistics. But that's very interesting, the points that you make. And it's that's probably the education variable.
But it's a separation of education variable versus cultural variable.
Yeah.
In a Muslim culture, you know, women are separated by men, but they're still, you know, 100% literacy educated.
Your Mongolia result would be the same factor. Would be the same many, many years of women working in the workforce as well as going through the same education.
Mongolia had 100% literacy?
Mongolia had very, very high urban literacy, and certainly urban women were as fully integrated into the workforce in the Soviet state as in Kyrgyzstan or in Kazakhstan, which also would have very high rates around this.
And also the fact that the internet allows you freedom that you can't otherwise have in the society. You can have social mobility on the internet. You can go places on the internet that in the culturally restrictive society you couldn't go. For instance, in Saudi Arabia, you know, young men and women meeting in the chat rooms when they can't meet in public. That I think that maybe that this is part of the attraction, that the women were already educated, but yet their social mobility wasn't, you know, full social mobility.
Well, it allows you to separate the non-use of internet because of literacy issue versus non-use of internet because of cultural issue.
Mm-hmm. Those are important points. Yes.
As you mentioned, the internet is not gender neutral. I've been hearing a lot of discussion here that seems to indicate that the internet is culturally neutral. And coming from a background in the history of philosophy and background in the study of Western Africa, African imperialism, I think that maybe the problem isn't to create cyber cafes, that the solution isn't to create cyber cafes in a particular culture, but to say maybe some of the resistance to this technology is because of the technology. And we might be in danger of imposing an information imperialism the way we did other kinds of cultural imperialism in the 19th and early 20th century. It also occurred to me that a lot of the issues you're bringing up in regards to the rural poor in developing nations are the same issues that we have in the United States in rural working single mother households. I've had these people as my students. As a specific example, my former point, you know, importing, I just wonder, you know, should we be using technology like a laptop where a book would do just as well? Because when you import a laptop, you import all the heavy metals, all of the toxins to a system that doesn't necessarily have any way of recovering or reusing things. There was just an article in the BBC yesterday that a lot of West Africa countries are the recipients of huge toxic waste in the form of supposedly usable technology, and it's now poisoning their environment, where in the West we've developed an infrastructure for taking care of this. I think maybe it's wise to say, just dumping these kinds of technologies on the developing world without an infrastructure to support it, as meaning a recycling infrastructure, that technological infrastructure, and understanding the cultural infrastructure might just not be a wise idea. That we're moving fast, perhaps maybe the third world shouldn't move so fast. What are your thoughts?
You're making lots of interesting points. Many, many people feel that obviously that the internet is not culturally neutral. The internet is a form of cultural imperialism. But all the efforts to talk about appropriate content and developing local content are reactions against that. And I'm sorry, I lost the train of thought that I wanted to make. Could you make your second major point again? I wanted to react to that.
The dumping.
Point about it being analogous to what's going on in the United States.
No, it was basically about the appropriateness of the technological box and of internet. Also, lots of questions have been raised about that, whether internet is the most appropriate technology for reaching rural areas, for reaching largely illiterate populations.
How many, for instance, books can you make for $100 versus one laptop?
Yeah.
That are then biodegradable. Mm-hmm. I mean, have you mentioned people have been speaking about this or questions that they raised? These in any particular place, or are there any particular names notable that are discussing these issues?
I mean, yeah, there's 15 years of debate on this. I'm trying to think of sort of, you know, where to start you on it. Certainly a lot of the debate right now is centered around the One Laptop Per Child project. And if you start looking at some of the big critiques offered on One Laptop Per Child, people are going fairly far down the lines that you're going. And certainly some people have tried to make it from the practical point of view, some people have tried to make the waste point that you've made, other people have tried to make the cultural imperialism point. On the waste point, probably the most useful critic to start with would be Joris Komen, who runs SchoolNet Namibia, who has a very careful analysis around computer recycling. Now, in fairness, it would be worth saying that Joris imports more computers than anybody else that I know, but he also has built an ISO 9000 compliant recycling center in Namibia to deal with the heavy metal disposal problem. One of the things he raises in the nature of OLPC is whether that's being taken seriously on that side of it. I would like to push back a little bit on the imperialism critique, which I think is useful to put out, but I also think needs to recognize that those of us who've sort of been out doing ICT for development for the last decade or so have seen sort of again and again leaders in the developing world insisting that this isn't one they want to be left behind on. And making the point that, yes, absolutely, you can print a few more books than you can make a laptop for $100, but it's very, very hard to disseminate your information without having interactive technology in one fashion or another. If you look at a country like Rwanda, which has essentially focused a huge amount of their economic development around technology, they're doing it precisely because they realize that there's no way that an agricultural economy is going to be able to sustain the population they have in such a small, crowded nation. So you have a lot of people reaching out for this as a hope for economic development. I guess I would argue that there's less sort of imposition than there is a great deal of pull going on at the same time. You could offer a whole lot of analysis about whether that pull is, you know, the result of overhype or marketing, but I will tell you that in my work going out and going into the field, I never had to sell what I was doing. I had people asking me to come in and do that work, which I guess would raise some questions about whether that concern about imperialism might be slightly misplaced.
Well, let me clarify imperialism. I'm thinking of imperialism as part of the Enlightenment project, which can be intellectual. It doesn't need to be someone saying, you will buy this. It can be, this is the thing to do. Information will provide liberation. There's this, which we've seen in the West, doesn't work. The Enlightenment project is fundamentally flawed. It's why we have postmodernity. And yet it seems that we have the same project replicating itself in a digital form in the third world. Now, I would qualify that by saying scientific advances within the Enlightenment project certainly have allowed us to do things like prolong life. But we still haven't answered the question about whether that's a good thing. You know, maybe we should be because now it's what seemed benign.
I mean, if we're gonna question the Green Revolution and, you know, improvements in agriculture and extensions of lifespan, I'm not sure that there's a lot of common ground to argue on. And if, you know, I have to accept, you know, the failure of the Enlightenment project and, you know, the spread of postmodernism, I guess what I'm trying to say is that those of us who have gone into large numbers of schools in the developing world have met with large numbers of teachers who have said, we understand that if these kids are going to do anything other than farm dirt and try to make potatoes grow out of land that's been, you know, devoid of minerals for 200 years, they're going to need access to skills that allow them to live in the larger world, which in many cases mean technical skills. Figuring out how to do that in a way that is affordable to desperately poor educational systems, and that has gender equity and equity between rural and urban divides, those seem like great questions to deal with. They're really big questions about whether people are better if they live 15 years longer or whether they have more knowledge. I guess, you know, I have a lot of trouble getting particularly hung up on those.
I think I think this is like a slight divergence from the general tenor of this conversation, which is about gender and ICT and a variety of other things, and not about this one. So that we can take that one offline and save it for later. But we really should
sharpen your swords for the duel.
Yeah, exactly.
There, you know?
We should wrap this up and let people get to their regular place. But I want to give Nancy a chance at a last word before we think. Not on this, but anything. You're just like, you just get to hold us all.
Especially not on this. Yeah.
Class doesn't end until you say it does.
No. I don't have a parting shot. I just find a lot of inspiration and a lot of leads from everything that everybody said that I'm trying hard to capture. But basically, in this area, it's still really a tabula rasa. There's so much work to be done, particularly in the statistics and indicators and in capturing what really is going on. I'm very much energized by talking to everybody here. Maybe some others are as well in terms of what they're going to.